can start. So we have it's a special day today, and we are celebrating the 75th anniversary of the IAP, and we have the pleasure and the honor to have Professor Peeble from Princeton, who will make a presentation about cosmology. And I think I feel, and as usual in this kind of event, you have to make an introduction to present the speaker. I feel a little bit stupid to have to do that for Professor Peeble because everybody knows him. And but nevertheless, I think I just want to remind you that he was one of the father of the what is called physical cosmology at the time where it was not thought as really a part of physics, and really with him and with other people, he was really the first to make a lot of progress in the theoretical work and the physics of the cosmology. And especially now this year with the result of Planck on CMB, I think it's really your work with Robert Dicke was the first demonstration of what we can do with the CMB to constrain cosmological model. And it's, of course, was just the beginning of your work, and then you work on many other things, primarily nucleosynthesis, galactic dynamics, cosmic velocity fields, and so on. So I think it's we'll not spend more time to explain what you did because it will be too long, and I'll give you the floor for this presentation. Thank you again for that.
It is a great pleasure to be back here. I've visited this institution on many occasions, but I've only recently become aware of when it was founded. I believe organized in 1936. I am sure discussions began in 1935, which is the year of my birth. I propose to give a broad overview of cosmology, and to that end, I begin by offering some reflections on, in the most general way, the nature of our enterprise in natural science. First statement, natural science is a social construction. That seems obvious enough. Who else? There is a hazard on occasion that people will decide that if it is social construction, then perhaps another society would have constructed another science. We cannot disprove that idea, only point out how absurdly unlikely is the idea. Consider such a person making the argument on a laptop computer. Imagine the technology, the depth of understanding of physics that made this possible. To imagine another science, absurd. Number two, attempts to make this point. We elevate parts of natural science from a construction to established science because it becomes predictive, making many more predictions than were elements that went into its construction. Number three, I think important to bear in mind, an established science need not be the final science. We have lots of examples where that was not the case, and I expect you will see it in the future. Number four, we change our established science to a new science under the imperative of data that do not fit the establishment. In history, I think I cannot think of a counterexample to the point that established science is adjusted or becomes a limiting case of a better science rather than being discarded. So here are the operating principles I'm going to adopt. And I propose now to consider whether each of the entries in this slide is to be considered a construction or to be considered established science. And I hope it will be borne in mind if I argue that your particular branch of cosmology is a construction, that is not a bad thing. Every established element of science began as a construction. So, I will allow you to consider which of these you would vote for. Will I point out some aspects of how the present state of cosmology came about, some examples of the way natural science is done as a social operation. I begin with the debate between fractal picture for the large-scale structure of the universe and a picture of homogeneity. You recall Einstein's argument. 1915, he had established general relativity theory. 1917, he turned to an aspect of relativity that must have disturbed him, as we see in later writing. His general relativity theory allows a galaxy alone to live in asymptotically flat space-time. That galaxy in general relativity theory may rotate and have all of the properties, the consequences of rotation, but it is rotation relative to empty space-time. Einstein argued that if the universe were constructed that way, then Mach, as is quoted here, would have been totally wrong in his thought that inertia as well as gravitation depends upon a kind of mutual action. This is not a science. This is not a theory. It is, at best, philosophy. Furthermore, furthermore, it is quite contrary to what was known at the time. Some speculated correctly that the spiral nebulae are other galaxies. Everyone knew, who cared to look, that the spiral galaxies are distributed in a decidedly irregular way across the sky. The empty band in the middle, some suspected, was due to obscuration. The views above and below seemed clear. Notice how many more galaxies there are above than below. Here, I put you, is a fractal universe. Why did people place so much emphasis on Einstein's homogeneity? It's the influence of society. Einstein had proved to be brilliant. He must be right once again. Through the years, astronomers did point out from time to time that the homogeneity assumption seemed questionable. I think it was Gerard Vaucouleurs, 1970, who first presented a clear, visible, and well-presented argument that the universe is fractal. Here are Antoinette and Gerard, Paris, 1962, elegant astronomers. Here is the paper, 1970. This paper, if presented 1960, would have been deeply influential and have forced us to reconsider our preconceived ideas. As it happens, by 1970, we were starting to accumulate evidence that the universe truly is homogeneous. Here, a copy of a transparency I used to show many years ago, showing the distribution across half the sky of radio sources. You see in the center a hole. The instrument could not reach that part of the sky. You see below, do I have a pointer? I have long arms, but not quite. But you see an isolated point. You see Cassiopeia A, bright. It's difficult to see radio sources nearby. For the rest, what do you see? Einstein's vision. Here a case where pure thought led to an aspect of reality. A remarkable thing, but it happens. Another example, cosmology. I might remark that it was ironic to me to see after the de Vaucouleurs paper a field of science grow up, fractal cosmology. There was never any good reason for that. Am I wrong? Steady state versus Big Bang. 1960. Which theory is more elegant? Surely the steady state cosmology requires fewer assumptions and makes more predictions. On the basis of pure thought, the universe surely is steady state rather than the Big Bang cosmology invented by or put together by the Belgian Georges Lemaître. Here, Fred Hoyle, Tommy Gold, talking to Freeman Dyson, arguing the merits of a steady-state universe. And an observation that totally eliminated classical steady-state. The universe filled with a sea of thermal radiation, the spectrum thermal to spectacular precision. This is not theory. That is a measurement with uncertainty small compared to the width of the curve. Thin line drawn through a thermal spectrum. It's spectacular. And you recall that in the steady state theory, there's nothing wrong with assuming continual creation of radiation, whose spectrum you may assume. But you remember that this observed radiation is a superposition of radiation coming from different redshifts. If, for example, spontaneous creation were of thermal radiation, then we would see a mix of radiation at different temperatures, quite contrary. An example of where one set of measurements, requiring enormous amounts of work, of course, but in the end, a very simple result, quite eliminates a beautiful idea. How the cosmological constant grew. Here you see Einstein, and I'm sorry to say, can you perhaps make out Einstein's signature? And here the American physicist Millikan, and you can just see the bottom of his signature. But Lemaître probably used black to sign on top of his gown, and perhaps that's lost forever. Here is a copy of a letter written by Einstein to Lemaître, 1947. Lemaître had written Einstein to put again his view that the cosmological constant has a role in cosmology. In particular, Lemaître was very obsessed with the thought that the cosmological constant sets the energy density of the vacuum. Talk about a perceptive remark. Here's Einstein's reply. Since I have introduced this term, lambda, I had always a bad conscience. I cannot help to feel it strongly, and I am unable to believe that such an ugly thing should be realized in nature. Here, a voice of great authority. Other great physicists totally endorsed this point of view. Wolfgang Pauli completely rejected the cosmological term. I fully accept this new standpoint of Einstein. Landau and Lifshitz, their magnificent series of books on theoretical physics. Nowhere in our equations do we consider the so-called cosmological constant. It has finally become clear there is no basis for such a term. Strong authority indeed. My first doubts about the elegance of the universe in which there is no cosmological constant, no space curvature, the Einstein-De Sitter universe, came when we had the first good measurements of relative velocity dispersions of galaxies. The first redshift sample by Mark Davis, results that made me feel that we couldn't have the high mass density of an Einstein-De Sitter universe. Here, a review several years later, arguing for an explanation of this low velocity dispersion, biasing. Galaxies are more strongly clustered than the mass. Mass smoothly distributed. It will then have much gravitational effect, and relative velocities will be small. Here, I love this first sentence. We have argued that biasing is not just an ad hoc contrivance introduced by theorists to save the philosophically attractive omega 1 equals model when confronted with apparently conflicting evidence. Perhaps some of you remember the U.S. President Richard Nixon, who was unfortunately involved in a clumsy burglary of the Democratic Party national headquarters. And Nixon complained, saying on one occasion, "I am not a crook," which of course made all of us wonder, perhaps similarly with this sentence. And indeed, although they put forward arguments that galaxies are a very poor tracer of mass, it made very little sense, because if you don't put the mass around the galaxies, where will you put it? You will put it in the void, surely. And if the voids contain mass but not galaxies, then the probability of forming a galaxy must be very hazardous indeed, meaning that those galaxies you do find in low-density regions ought to show the signs of an unfortunate use, irregular, criminal, messy. But you don't see that, and you didn't see it then. So, I come to the cosmological model. I have not talked about cold dark matter. It is a hypothetical element in the standard cosmology of today, along with lambda, a hypothetical element. And I now present my thinking on the case that this model with its hypothetical components is to be considered established. The way I like to approach this these days is to make use of the beautiful measurements of the CMB by the Planck satellite mission, earlier WMAP, by ground-based observatories that allow them to choose a special case of lambda CDM with, whereas Dwagnat, no space curvature, a constant lambda, Gaussian adiabatic departures from homogeneity, power law power spectrum, and tilt. It adds up to six parameters. That six parameter fit gives this anisotropy spectrum. If you don't follow this spectrum, just realize that it is the generalization on the sphere of a power spectrum. Take the Fourier transform of the distribution, square it, plot the amplitude as a function of wave number. Same game here, except you use spherical harmonics instead of Fourier components. Spectacular fit, just gorgeous. Over so many orders of magnitude and scale, all the little wiggles faithfully reproduced, it's gorgeous. That by itself, I think, makes a strong case for this lambda CDM six-parameter model. But I think we can go better and finesse the complaints of skeptics who will say, look, with six parameters, you can fit a lot. And that is a good point. So we may instead take the tack of taking these parameters as a benchmark and then asking what other measurements, independent of CDM, do they describe and fit well. So I have here an array of images that you are not meant to read. Instead, you are meant to admire and take joy in the spectacular variety of measurements that fit our benchmark lambda CDM. To begin, redshift magnitude relation for type 1a supernovae. Spectacular work. Got a Nobel Prize for it. Gorgeous. We are using it only as an illustration of consistency of lambda CDM with a broad variety of phenomena. These measurements are done in an entirely different way from CMB measurements. They measure different phenomena. They look at different by different methods. And yet, the data, tightly clustered, follow the solid curve you can barely see, predicted by our benchmark. It is this variety outside the data used to construct the model that is so impressive. One hears on occasion the thought that cosmology is based on what we can deduce from our world line and what we can deduce from what we see along our light cone going back out, an exceedingly tiny slice of space-time. But that's not really true. Consider that the matter distribution, as reflected in the galaxies, has a power spectrum with wiggles in it. Here you see the wiggles, and here they are amplified by taking out the trend. They correspond to the wiggles you saw in the anisotropy spectrum for the CMB. Except that these measurements are made at galaxies relatively nearby. The CMB is observed back on the light cone at redshift 1000. These wiggles reflect what happened, well, in this plot showing CMB anisotropy measurements. This one, for example, at redshift 0.2, is describing what happened to the matter at redshift 0.2 as it evolved from high redshift. It has a deduced wavelength that is consistent with the standard model based on measurements of what happened to the radiation at redshift 1000. There is not much room in there for a radial density gradient in a spherically symmetric universe. Similarly, you go to higher redshift, you again sample what happened along a world line that then emitted radiation that we see along the light cone. We can continue at great length here, back to low redshift, the redshift magnitude relation from the Hubble Key Project, getting a Hubble constant with a numerical value consistent with what is deduced from the CMB. Spectacular. Here, a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, a measurement of a stellar evolution age. Again, a quite different phenomenon. Not a tight measurement, not high precision, because we can only assert that this thing at age deduced 13.5 gigayears is less than age deduced from CDM, 14 gigayears, but it is a test and an impressive one. Here, one can look at red galaxies at different redshifts, deduce from their spectrum an evolution age, and compare that evolution age to what you would expect if the galaxies formed at high redshift and then passively evolved. That's a solid curve. This is a very low accuracy data. But accuracy really isn't the point here, it's precision. Are we reflecting the real world? And again, yes, it's working. Oh, the coma cluster. Historically interesting because the high velocities of galaxies in this cluster led Zwicky in the 1930s, at about the time IAP was established, to deduce that there's something wrong with our understanding of mass. He introduced the term dark matter, Dunkel matter. Here, historically interesting, the mass fraction in dark matter is the mass fraction in baryons in clusters drove Simon White, Carlos Frink, and colleagues to great distraction. Their beloved Einstein de Serre universe wasn't working. Again, a crude measurement, but consistent with lambda CDM. Perhaps I'll not go on. I think I've made the point. I conclude that by all the standards and conventions we use in doing science, lambda CDM is established science. There will be time for you to debate this, I hope. But I wish instead at this point to comment on the lessons we learned from the story of the development of lambda CDM. First, the subject grew through advances in technology. I put in manipulation because, of course, that's important in other branches of science, but detection and data handling. A spectacular change from the days of the Bell Telephone Communications Laboratory when there were explorations of how one might communicate with microwaves, leading us to all these dreadful twitters. But 50 years ago, leading the engineers to realize that they were detecting radiation they could not understand, the CMB. But compare that operation with the Planck satellite. Quite a change. Occasional shrewd deductions from evidence that happens not to be misleading. Zwicky, dark matter in the coma cluster. Persistent trial and error explorations. Well, let's see. Blind good luck is to be emphasized. But also, shrewd, where are we? Oh, yeah, no, where? Oh, yeah. I'd forgotten the order. I emphasize that physical science is a social construction subject to social pressures. For example, we are sometimes blinded to promising directions that are against the better judgment of leading figures. Remember all those pronounced comments on lambda. Sometimes, social pressures lead us in the right direction, even in the face of confusing evidence. Consider Einstein's homogeneity. And of course, where would we be if people didn't push ideas? Our science develops in chaos, but somehow moves forward, undeniably. So with these lessons in mind, let us turn to other of the entries in that first slide I showed. Is galaxy formation theory to be considered a construction or established science? The theory is based on lambda CDM. I've just said that lambda CDM is, in my opinion, well and fully established. So why am I questioning galaxy formation theory? I think the basic point is it's possible that lambda CDM is not adequate fully, but rather requires a generalization to understand galaxies. I will try to explain what I mean. Here is the galaxy luminosity function, probability distribution function in luminosities of galaxies, numbers of galaxies per unit volume as a function of luminosity. Here, from numerical simulations of pure dark matter in lambda CDM, is the mass function of clusters of dark matter. Here is the measured mass function of galaxies. They touch by a reasonable adjustment of normalizations. At one point, that's something, but far from a good fit. One obtains a magnificent fit by adjusting lots of parameters. Here they are listed. It is to be understood one must adjust parameters because we have so many unknowns. We do not understand how galaxies form. We do not understand how galaxies once form affect their surroundings, both while they're stars and evolving and when they explode. All of that uncertainty must be parameterized, and therefore this must be done. But it means that we are not going to be able to count this beautiful fit as a prediction. It's a construction. It's not bad, but it doesn't convince us that these people are on the right track. Here is a prediction. Having adjusted parameters to fit the galaxy luminosity function, simulators and those who use halo occupation, distribution, abundance matching models can predict, having fit the luminosity function, the galaxy correlation function. It works pretty well. I would count this as a prediction. So, of course, do the authors. That is the first entry here. It is related. We have a galaxy-galaxy cross-correlation function. Set on a galaxy, what's the probability of finding a galaxy at a given distance away? You can also look, sit on a galaxy and ask how much mass do you see on average a given distance away? How much mass can be determined by looking at motions of gas around the galaxy, of stars, of satellites, and furthermore, further out still, of weak lensing and strong lensing. One is measuring roughly the same thing because we know galaxies are a reasonably good tracer of mass. These two statistics are the same. Yet a third statistic is the Tully-Fisher relation. You tell me the luminosity of a spiral galaxy, I'll tell you how fast it's rotating. At least I won't, astronomers will. And how fast it's rotating within lambda CDM is a measure of its mass, the inverse square law. Here again is a galaxy mass correlation. And finally, the great conspiracy. Here, from von Albeda and colleagues many years ago, circular velocity in a spiral galaxy is a function of radius. Here are the measurements. Here, the deduced contribution to the mass is causing the velocity to by disk stars. Here, halo, dark matter, the sum not reflecting the transition from dominance by stars to dominance by dark matter. Again, it is center of the galaxy, mass, cross-correlation function. These are all somehow related. The curiously tight Tully-Fisher relation, if you take account of not only stars, but gaseous components, has caused some to ask whether lambda CDM really can be trusted. I don't know how to decide that. The people who simulate the models of galaxies do not seem worried. It is somehow connected to these other measures in ways that I would love to see discussed more thoroughly. I think we could add, as a prediction of sorts, the evolution of the galaxy luminosity function. I should have said luminosity, not mass, as shown here. It's pretty good, though not overwhelming. And I wonder if there's more. I'd be willing to be instructed, but I hope you'll understand I'm not ungrateful to the people who make these models. They're doing brilliant work. But life is short, and we're not getting a lot of predictions out of an awful lot of construction. That has led me to think that we might do well to look for aspects of galaxies whose properties can be rather simply interpreted without having to understand a lot about the effects of star formation. I offer an example, my current favorite, pure disk galaxies, in which the motions of almost all the stars are close to parallel to the plane, largely rotating in circles, but maybe moving along bars, very little of the mass in a stellar bulge or halo. I offer an example. The galaxy nearby, M101, incidentally, sticking out into the void, it's one of these galaxies that you would have thought under biasing would have a malnourished youth, but it's perfectly normal. I must also say that you astronomers have a spectacular argument to make in the competition for funds for pure research. So many people are fascinated by such beautiful images as this. The Higgs just can't compare. Here I have defaced the image by putting in its provenance and adding an inset from, which one have I been using? From John Cormody and colleagues. This is an HST enlargement of the very center. You see that the spiral arm structure continues to a tiny star cluster. Dust is causing these spiral arms. Dust tends to settle to the plane dissipatively. It is an indication, therefore, that you can see most of the starlight, a lot of the starlight is coming from the plane, for if otherwise it wouldn't be obscured by the dust that's in the plane. This could be made more quantitative. I would love to see someone make measurements of surface brightness in here and here, as to be compared to surface brightness way out here, to see how much stars there could be above the plane of dust. Doesn't look like there's much. This looks like it's a pure disk, no bulge. Our Milky Way is another example. I'm instructed by those who know such things that the stars near the center of the Milky Way are moving in circles on cylinders. Here, the streaming velocity running across the Milky Way plane showing rotation. Here, the velocity dispersion small compared to the rotation. Again, looks like a thin disk without that classical bulge that we see so often. Here, another example, the galaxy seen edge on. This illustrates as in the Milky Way, we have Sagittarius stream. And here, this guy has, under an ultra-deep exposure, this wonderful stream of stars, something perhaps analogous to the Sagittarius stream. But it's very faint. You see, you have to expose the thing very heavily in order to pick it up. The lesson, there are lots of galaxies, at least nearby, in which the stars' motions are all confined almost entirely, with exceptions, of course, but almost entirely, to the plane. Now we ask, how could that come about in Lambda CDM? Here is a simulation of pure dark matter, of the distribution of matter in a Lambda CDM universe, not quite the present parameters, but close enough for our work, redshift 3, 1, 0, plotted. All stars that are within 3 kpc of the center are plotted in yellow at all redshifts. Stars between 3 and 7 kpc plotted in black. Recall, we're out at 8 kpc. Stars outside 7 and inside the nominal Vireo radius at the present time, where the system is roughly in equilibrium, are plotted in gray tones. There is, of course, matter out here. That matter is not plotted anywhere. What do you see? It's really spectacular. This scale, 300 kpc over h, this is somewhat antique notation. H is 0.7, we all know. So that's about 400 kpc. That's a big length. Remember, this is 7 and 3. Here is where the matter, now there, it was at redshift 3, here at redshift 1. Here is where the matter now at redshift within 3 in yellow and overprinted black, or 7 KPC is now. A spectacular exchange of matter that shows something that used to be well known in the in-body communication, in-body simulation community, maybe still is. A dark matter, a particle that is in a dense region, tends to stay in a dense region. Here you see it illustrated, and you see it illustrated even in more detail here. Whoops. Let's discuss this first. Here is one of those dark matter halo simulations showing the same game. Here is, we have removed the color tones, and you can see the dense patches are lit up. They are what ends up close to the center. I wish to just point out some numbers. You know, this is a polite gathering. Maybe I don't want to talk about these numbers. They just quantify the fact that a lot of material is flowing. Well, let's just show it. On average, the mass within 7 KPC is this much in units of 10 to the 10th. This much mass has flown in since redshift 3. This much mass has flown out. There is a considerable transport of material through this central region, sloshing through and on out. So we come to the big question. How do we understand the growth of pure disk galaxies under these conditions? I remind you here that at redshift 1, star formation rate density is an order of magnitude bigger than now, and it stays high back to redshift 3, perhaps beyond that. Stars are forming in abundance back then. Where would they form? Isn't it reasonable to think that they'd form in those yellow regions that are dense? And if they form back there at redshift 1 to 3 in the yellow regions, where are they going to be now? They're not going to end up in a thin disk. They come plunging in at orbits oriented all over the place. You're not going to make a thin disk. You're going to make a bulge or stellar halo. You disagree? Oh, we'll discuss it. I consider this flying in the face of a reasonable interpretation of lambda CDM. Now, here's a simulation that, in fact, avoids my objection. By a construction, set the threshold for star formation to be very high. The result is this elegant-looking galaxy with some very interesting properties. First, here is the distribution of stars in the bulge. The bulge, as it is now, the blue line. The positions of the stars now in the bulge when they formed in the solid line. These bulge stars formed in place. They didn't plunge in. Here, the present distribution of stars in the disk in blue. Here, the present distribution of the stars when they formed. They formed in place. This is elegant, but I don't trust it. I look again at this, and I ask myself, what became of all those stars that were forming at redshift 3? What did you do with them? Perhaps you needn't answer that question. Interpretations. These simulations are totally misleading. But I put it to you that a star is a perfectly good dark matter particle once formed. Second, maybe pure disk galaxies are exceptional. But John Cormody instructs me. We've looked. Not very far, of course, because you can't make these distinctions between pure bulges and pure disk galaxies at great distance. But among the 20, do I remember right, galaxies nearby with circular velocities greater than 150, counting all galaxies, half are pure disks. Some of the rest are ellipticals, others have bulges, but half pure disks. I put it to you that this is crazy. Oh, I guess just briefly, this is an elegant model, but a third of its luminosity is in that bulge. It's not a modest bulge. And second, here is the distribution function of angular momentum. For each star at its present position, compute the component of its angular momentum normal to the disk. And to compare that to the angular momentum it would have if it were in circular motion at its present position in the disk. So you see a spike at unity. These stars are moving in near circular orbits. You see a spike here at zero. This looks to me not like motion in cylinders as we see in the Milky Way, but rather random motions as in an elliptical in the center, a classical picture for a classical bulge of a spiral, with stars rotating both counter-rotating and rotating in about equal abundances. This, I think, is a good model for our neighbor, M31, which has a prominent bulge, but it doesn't look like a good model for the Milky Way. I've forgotten how much, I never do remember to take note of time. Have I been talking long? Well, there will be time for discussion because I'm near the end, close, not there. Here, again, it is so, I find it so much joy in looking for phenomena that are, may I say, elegant and perplexing. Here, Guangdong Zhu and his colleagues have taken Sloan Digital Sky Survey spectra of early type galaxies. And they have divided these early type galaxies into three classes. I'm showing here two, low sigma and high sigma. In these two classes, we separate those galaxies that are in relatively dense environments and those in low density environments. So two velocity dispersion classes, big and small, two environments. Plotted is the ratio of average flux, average across all of the galaxies in the sample, average spectrum, and divide the average spectrum of low sigma by the average spectrum of high sigma. This is then, here it is, 1.84 to 2.10 in the logarithm, velocity dispersion, in the numerator, in the denominator, 2.3 to 2.5 velocity dispersion. Immense numbers of galaxies, the power of modern astronomy, you can average over enormous ensembles and get low noise and see a wonderfully elegant trend. First, you see this trending up as you go to the blue. Remember, the numerator is low sigma galaxies. We see immediately that low sigma galaxies are bluer than high sigma galaxies. It just hits you in the face. Hitting me in the face, too, is the fact that the field and rich group, so-called, that is to say, low ambient density and high ambient density, blue and red, are distinguished. The statistics are so exquisitely good that you can see a difference, but then you pause to consider, wow, that difference is so spectacularly small. What a beautiful systematic. There are some distinct differences. See this spike at H alpha. If the elliptical is in a low density region and it has low sigma, it has much higher chance of making some stars that are making some H alpha. A real difference that depends on environment. But put that aside, and what really impresses me is how little, on average, an elliptical in a low-density region differs from that of an elliptical in a high-density region. Is that intuitive within lambda CDM? Well, I don't want to do that. All right, the big question, how did the galaxies grow? Ellipticals, we all know, ask any expert, they grew by dry mergers. Dry as in no gas, plummeting in, to build up the elliptical, to account, for example, for the evidence that ellipticals are getting bigger as time goes on. Gas-poor satellites are falling onto them, the standard picture. Pure disks, they had to have grown by wet streams and mergers. Streams so wet that they contain no stars to speak of. Otherwise, you're going to build a bulge. I offer an example of a gas-rich galaxy. What did I do? I should hold it at all times. Here is a gas-rich galaxy in our local void. It's well away from anybody. It's a pathetically small thing, little cluster of stars, a big envelope of H1 around it. It's not the most gas-rich galaxy known, but it's getting there. Its luminosity translates to a mass in stars of around 10 to the 9th. The mass in H1, sorry, 10 to the 8th. The mass in H1, about 10 to the 8th. This is a gas-rich galaxy, but it's not a good building block for a pure disk galaxy, because you'll be dumping in, as you add mass in gas to make the disk, masses in stars that are comparable. The building blocks for pure disk galaxies have to be much wetter than this. The building blocks for ellipticals have to be much drier. Why the great dichotomy? Why is there such a vast difference in the way ellipticals and spirals form? How do they know that they're going to end up as an elliptical? And tell their environment, quick, make all stars, don't bring any gas. But the Milky Way, right next to M31 that has a bulge, Milky Way, no, come in as pure gas, stars excluded. It's a remarkable thing in my way of thinking. And it leads me to ask, well, no, I think my next, yes, so my summary slide. I have fewer entries than in my first slide, just to make room for some comments. And to begin with, Einstein's lambda, established. How can we get away from it? We have that magnificent array of tests that I showed you that are consistent. By all of the rules of our profession, lambda is there. We may say again, perhaps lambda will go away. And I guess it must happen in science that an established theory is discarded totally. But I can't think of an example. And so I think if you were making odds, betting, you would put heavy odds. Lambda is here to stay. It could be that you'll invent a new gravity theory, which in a limiting case is general relativity plus lambda. No problem with that. But operationally, we have it. Non-baryonic dark matter. It's established. I stress that if the dark matter searches never turn up anything more than the one component we know exists, neutrinos, then it will not disestablish lambda CDM. Why should nature show us its dark matter? Not required. Dark matter is already established, I argue, and its discovery will be of immense value and gratification, but immense value because it will show us the place of dark matter in physics. The place of lambda? Nowhere. It's a total insult to us all. Lambda CDM cosmology, well, I've already said it, established. But I want to stress again that I do not conclude that lambda CDM is the final cosmology for the purposes of cosmology and astronomy at redshifts less than 10 to the 10th. We don't know that. And we know, indeed, that the universe is a very large place, quite capable of surprising us yet again. The theory of galaxies. Without a doubt, this is a very active and rich and productive field. Observations are driving theory. Theory is being driven by the advances in computation, simulations, in modeling, and in perhaps not quite as much, analytics. I think we are going to see great advances in galaxy formation theory. I remain skeptical that we have what one would say colloquially a full deck. You know, the gamblers will remove cards from a deck of cards to change the odds. Do we have all of the cards in the deck? Do we really have the right idea within lambda CDM of how galaxies form? Do we even know that lambda CDM has all the right physics that we will need to understand galaxies? I think the answers to both questions are, we don't know. My bet, it may only be the fond hope of someone who is a year older than this institute, that there is more to be discovered. but I think the odds make a lot of sense. We are going to be surprised in the next decade about our theory of galaxy formation. One hears a lot of talk these days about a De Sitter phase in the evolution of the universe. It is pointed out that a De Sitter phase is necessary for us to understand the near-scale invariance of the density fluctuations revealed by the CMB measurements. It's required. This is an argument that makes me feel very uncomfortable. The De Sitter phase exists because we cannot think of an alternative. The interpretation may be, you haven't thought hard enough, and so I can't give it anything more than a social construction grade. De Sitter phase, well, and inflation, it is well to separate the De Sitter phase from inflation because inflation adds elements which make it predictive. When inflation was built, it did not include the notion of Gaussianity. Scale invariance, I believe, was included. I think that's fair to say. But Gaussianity is a prediction. The tilt from scale invariance is a prediction of sorts, but alas, although it's been heavily cried up as a confirmation of this of inflation, if the tilt weren't seen, one would adjust the potential of inflation. It's a construction. The multiverse. The notion isn't it remarkable that lambda is there at a value that is not harmful? The answer, the resolution of that remark, well, there are many universes, we live in one, clearly, where lambda is not harmful. Isn't it amazing that water freezes, when freezing expands so that ponds and lakes and the oceans don't freeze over? Well, the explanation is clear. We live in a universe in which water expands when freezing. It's one construction per explanation. It's explanatory. It leaves me totally cold. But I want to emphasize the last entry. We have, through our history, so many examples of ideas or evidence that were not appreciated. And, of course, they are to be added to ideas and evidence yet to be discovered. I think that is going to continue to advance science and save us from a dismal end, which must come at some time. We cannot continue our present breakneck advances in the natural sciences forever. Eventually, we will be led to predictions that we cannot afford to test, with the world's economy devoted to our goal. But I think we're a long way from that. And I conclude with the last thought. Although it is very good that, for example, funding agencies around the world have been persuaded to devote large resources to the search for the evolution of lambda. It's called dark energy searches. It is, of course, more than a little dishonest, because the great benefit reaped from these searches for the evolution of lambda is all of the great astronomy that's being done. And I'm a little nervous that funding agencies will be eventually notice that they are being tricked into providing money for something that sounds so romantic, dark energy. Well, what they're really doing is just advancing science. That is why I emphasize that it is a good idea for all of you to spend some of your time thinking outside the box, in the colloquial term. Think a little away from the popular line of ideas. It's worked before, and it will work again. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for a few questions, but please wait that I give you the microphone before taking the question.
Magnificent talk. Concerning the way galaxy form, I fully agree with what you say. I mean, they're still developing theory, and we have to expect surprises. On the other hand, I just disagree a little bit with your comment about the John Comandy, pseudo bulge stuff. I mean, this has been developed, the theory has been also developed by Phil Hopkins and supported by observations which have been done in Europe, I mean, from our team.
Yes.
And indeed, it is possible, maybe if you can show the NGC 5907, the beautiful loops, gigantic loops. Oh, yeah, this one.
There it is.
Yes, so this one is a galaxy without, with a pseudo bulge too. I mean, very small bulge. And, it is possible to reconstruct this one. It has been published actually, as well as all these gigantic loops, assuming that the progenitors are very gas rich.
Yes.
In the very early universe. So say 9-10 billion years ago. Okay. And with such a things, you can reconstruct this one, especially if you account for the fact, and it's a very important fact, that if you observe this kind of galaxy in near infrared, you find that it is not simply a thin disk, but it is also a thick disk. And the part of the thick disk, the contribution of thick disk is almost half the light. So at the end, you can rebuild exactly this, the kind of object with pseudo bulge claimed by John Comandy not being consistent with the merger, you can rebuild those ones.
Yeah. You said the essential point, pure gas mergers.
Yeah, exactly.
And do you know how to prevent the gas coming in?
It's pure gas, 70% of gas in a galaxy. That's not that far from what we find at Z equal 3 from observation, present observation.
You have H1 observations, is that
equal? No, unfortunately, is not direct observation, I agree.
Here we are. The thick disk, of course, I would not include as an anomaly. a thick disk may form in many ways. It is the absence of the bulge, the classical bulge that concerns me. I fully agree with your statement. If material that rains down onto this forming galaxy is extremely gas-rich, very few stars, then all is well. I only worry about ellipticals nearby that are being fed pure stars. It surely is a wonderful challenge to those of you who make study the formation of galaxies. And what more could you ask for? Better than a solution, really.
Just to amplify that point, Jim, and contrary to what Francois is saying, I think you find the simulations which make the thin disk use supernova feedback, and the best simulations use 300% of the energy from the supernova to give the feedback, and only then can they succeed in getting these disks and stopping the bulge from forming.
Yes.
So
yes.
There's something wrong with the simulations, even the best ones today.
Oh, say that again. What is wrong with the simulations?
They need too much feedback.
Yes.
And they also make stars far too early. I mean, there are major problems, but in particular,
yes.
If you say they can explain thin disks, they're incredibly unphysical to do that.
This is new to me. I heard you lecture just a few months
days ago.
Days. Did you say that?
Most likely.
If so, I missed it. Is this published?
Just continuing on this topic, because I think you pointed out very well the difficulties on the galaxy formation, and I feel that that's a very key problem. Now, can't we say that it boils down to basically understanding what controls the star forming process? Why, in some cases, you get cold gas, which does not form stars, and in some other cases. And this contradiction is seen in our own galaxy, I think. You see molecular clouds, especially in the outer galaxy, which has 10 to the 5 solar masses of cold molecular gas, which form very little stars. And people have been saying, well, we don't see them with IRAS, then we don't see them with Spitzer. Then I think there is evidence that basically they are not there. And And so the feedback mechanism is probably also not only because we need more energy than what Joe was saying, but also because it might be energy stored which stops for formation in a redistributed way in space and time. But still, at the very early stage, we need mechanism to stop that in the very early, very first objects, the dark matter halos, which collapse. So I think we miss one mechanism which prevents star formation even there, and we have not found it.
Right. I am led to think of bistability. Either a gas cloud will decide to form stars or not, that conditions nearby will determine that within the range of a forming galaxy will determine a setting for a bistability. Either you can make stars or you cannot. What could cause such a bistability to be discovered?
So switching to the ellipticals, you seem to make the point, maybe I misunderstood, that the high and low mass ellipticals were formed by dry mergers. And it seems from simulations that you cannot form the small ellipticals by dry mergers simply because the subhalos within massive halos are not built by mergers. And we have the resolution to see that. And we know that in the massive halos, the small galaxies are mainly dwarf ellipticals. So the dwarf ellipticals cannot be formed by mergers. And we have the resolution to see that. So that means they must be formed by transforming dwarf irregulars into what they are, into their present state. So I would go along Carmody's ideas here that there's a difference between the dwarf ellipticals and the giant ellipticals and their formation mechanism.
Yes. There are dwarf ellipticals out in the field that live alone. A few examples. In the Leo 1 group, there's a nice, L-star elliptical. Are there dwarf ellipticals outside the environments of giant ellipticals? No, yes, there are. Well, I guess the dwarf spherules around our Milky Way are another category entirely.
Yes. Rad pressure stripping might be also the origin of the dwarf ellipticals in massive clusters.
Right.
But there, right. There are other ideas that are hanging around.
Yes, good.
No conviction about the evolution from dynamic to, I should say, a secular process. We are reaching the very deep universe now. In this very deep, we are observing massive galaxies, only massive because they are very bright.
Yes.
And these massive galaxies are full of stars, and the stars are 13 years older. So they are. It's very convincing that we are seeing the whole population that you showed on the paper by Carollo and so on. We are seeing these stars. And when we approach, we separate the problem of numerical simulation and we are analyzing the stellar evolution and we are able to date and to measure the mass of stars, it is exactly that star formation history that we found. So you may be convinced about this result. After, it's another story to understand what is a physical process. About feedback, I share the comment by Joe. I think the feedback is an ad hoc parameter to stop the star formation. The star formation was very, very strong at the highest redshift.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. In giant ellipticals, I assume, in the Milky Way, Rosie Weiss is my guide to the Milky Way. She assures me the Milky Way disk was present at redshift 2. Yes.
In the early universe.
Yes.
It's clear from the data.
Yes. It's one of these many curious non-intuitive aspects of galaxy formation theory as we now have it. The intuitive result from the buildup of the dark matter halos is in the opposite direction of evolution from what you observe.
not opposite. It appears that we are evolving from the secular process to the dynamical process. Yes. That's clear.
In the last transparency of your talk, you mentioned the list of items. Some of them are established, as you say, and some of them, for the moment, they are explanatory or just a construction. And two of them, inflation and the multiverse. Of course, I understand, I fully agree with you, this is the status. Still, they are very important. They are connected to deep questions, even philosophical ones, about the origin of our universe and so on. So my question is, how do you think that will be progress in that way? Do you think that at some point we shall have answers to those questions about the multiverse or not? What do you think could be done in that direction?
We should never give up. We have been surprised so many times. I don't know whether I remember to remark that through much of my career in cosmology, Hubble's constant was known to a factor of 2, and the mass density of the universe to a factor maybe 10, 30. For me to show you a table in which these numbers are measured to 1% or so is almost unreal. Nobody in my youth had any idea we'd be here today. Predictions are very uncertain, particularly predictions about the future. And I think that's the best comment I can make to your very, very germane remarks. Yes, we will continue to wonder about deeper and ever deeper questions. Who knows where we'll be led?
I'm sorry to ask a question that is less philosophical than Nicolas, and going back. I'm not a specialist in extragalactic astronomy. However, there's one expression which is totally missing in your talk, and I was surprised by that. It's clusters of galaxies. If I listen to your talk, you speak of course, the universe, the structure, and then lambda CDM and whatever, and then galaxy formation. But it seems that clusters of galaxies, to my remote knowledge, play a very important role in the structure of the universe. We know a lot about them. They are even in themselves providing some interesting tests of lambda CDM, you know, for massive clusters. They provide exchanges with the environment and so on. So could you comment on the role of clusters of galaxies?
You understand, I had to be selective. I did give a little hint of the rich science you mentioned in this one,
yes,
transparency.
One of the
balances. You see lower... Let me remind myself. You see lower left, the galaxy, the cluster mass function. You see upper right, the baryon mass fraction. Hints of what the great variety of phenomena and theory you mentioned. Yes, clusters are important. I also am led to emphasize, I think, as far as we know, the formation of clusters is understood within lambda CDM. Perhaps a few parameters to be adjusted, but nothing serious. Cluster formation, well understood, as best I know. Galaxy formation, I think a different story. In part, of course, because galaxies may be examined in much greater detail, even than clusters. And so, of course, we're more demanding of the theory. But yes, clusters are important. You are entirely right. They played an important role in the development of lambda CDM, and they are continuing to instruct us on the nature of that theory.
Thank you.